the National Urban League, who has said that the median household income for black people in the U.S. is 37% lower than that of white people. Why does racism in all of its forms, like in this case income, still persist in the U.S. to the extent that it does? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why it is difficult for people of color to overcome systemic racism in the U.S. in all of its forms.
An annual report by a New York-based civil rights organization has once again turned the spotlight on systemic racism and bias in the United States. The National Urban League's report showed that African Americans, despite making economic and health gains, still get just about 74% of what white people enjoy in the country. The organization demonstrates how difficult it is for people of color to overcome systemic racism.
These numbers change so little and so slowly. What it tells me is that this institutional disparity based on race seems to be built into American society.
The findings show the median household income for black people is 37% less than that of white people and are less likely to benefit from home ownership. The report also touches upon educational gaps.
Black and white preschoolers are roughly equally prepared, but the classrooms they enter are starkly different. Schools with more minority students are more likely to have inexperienced, less trained, and even uncertified teachers. Fewer of these students are enrolled in the STEM classes that can lead to higher-paying jobs. Black students are less likely to graduate from college.
On voting rights, the report says state legislatures have been restricting voting access in districts with large populations of black Americans, Latinos, and Native Americans. The report also points to U.S. Justice Department statistics saying black people have been more than twice as likely as their white counterparts to experience threats or uses of force during police encounters and three times more likely to be jailed if arrested. The grim findings come nearly 2 years after the U.S. underwent a major reckoning on racism following the brutal killing of African-American George Floyd by a white police officer. His death ignited nationwide protests and demands for equality and end to police brutality against people of color. Nonetheless, the National Urban League's report has highlighted the fact that racial inequality in the U.S. is deep-rooted. It stems from years of injustice and institutionalized racism against African Americans and other minority groups, which worsened during Donald Trump's presidency. Anti-racism demonstrations have also failed to bring about any tangible change in previous years.
Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Joining us is Gerald Horn, professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston, who joins us from Houston, Texas. Also joining us, Joseph Richardson, professor of African American studies and anthropology at the University of Maryland from Laurel, Maryland.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Gerald Horn, let me first start with you. And I have to say, if you did not catch on, that this was a report by the civil rights group National Urban League. So obviously your opinion of that organization is very important. But basically, one of the conclusions it has reached is that systemic racism is holding back black Americans. And it says black people in the U.S. are trailing white people in critical areas. That includes wealth, education, social justice, health, and civic engagement. Are you surprised at that, first of all?
No, I'm not surprised. And those who are surprised have not been paying attention to U.S. history. That is to say, when the European settlers and colonists began invading in North America in the 1500s and 1600s, they set up a society that was exclusive. It was only tended to benefit those who were like themselves. They liquidated the indigenous population for the most part, and then handcuffed Africans and dragged them across the Atlantic to be slaves. And we have not been able to transcend that original sin to the point where, as your reporter suggested, the prisons are overflowing with Black Americans. Black Americans are more likely to be subjected to the death penalty, that is to say, executed by the arm of the state. Black people are more likely to be shot down in the streets by the police forces. And with regard to housing discrimination, the latest revelation is that if a Black person is trying to sell their home, they find they can get more for their home if they take down the pictures on the walls of their Black relatives and leave the walls bare, or put up pictures of those who are defined as white. I can think of no worse example of the kind of white supremacy that obtains in the United States of America.
Joseph Richardson, you know, this National Urban League actually produced the first state of Black America in its report that, based on what it said, it captured the plight of the people who had been victims of systemic racism since arriving, as it said, in the shores of the U.S. And when you take a look at the year that report was published, it was back in 1976. Of course, Gerald Horn there goes back even further. When you have organizations like this and similar to this issuing out alarm bells and describing how this systemic racism is going on, and it's still, based on its most recent report, is even in some sense gotten worse, then why aren't there any action plans set forward? Or have they, and it's just not working?
I believe that there have been action plans that have been set forward, and there are many scholars who have addressed the wealth gap in this country. We only need to look at the work of economist Sandy Darity at Duke University, who has been making the argument for reparations, and we've heard discussions and policies recommending and advocating for reparations across this nation. But if to hark back onto the work of Dr. Darity found just in terms of the wealth gap in America, and it's quite interesting that we often emphasize the educational gaps, but what Dr. Darity found in terms of the differences in wealth is that white Americans, even those who have not graduated from high school and dropped out of high school, have greater wealth than Black Americans who have a college degree. And so his argument is that there really isn't a way to educate ourselves out of the great wealth gap and disparities that we have between Blacks and whites without having another form of remediation, and that would be in the form of reparations. Because as you mentioned, that report was made in 1976, and not much has changed in terms of Black wealth over the past 50 years. And in fact, we know that during the Obama administration, Black Americans actually lost more wealth because much of our wealth has been tied to home ownership. And so that intergenerational transference of wealth hasn't happened in the same way for Black Americans as it has traditionally benefited white Americans in this country.
One of the most alarming, at least in terms of what I saw, Gerald Horn, of this report is how it talked about voting rights. And taking a look at the statement that it made there, it was very interesting in the way that it described it. And it said that it was actually an anti-democratic move that began after the 2008 election, when Black voting rates actually matched white voting rates for the first time, which catapulted Barack Obama into office. This sounds an awful lot like a UN report that recently came out talking about voting rights of minorities denied in parts of the U.S., mentioning Texas as one of those states. That sounds like Black voting is being, or Black votes are being suppressed. Is that what this is about, which is resulting in gerrymandering? And perhaps you can describe that for us.
Well, gerrymandering is the process whereby congressional districts or state legislative districts are drawn in such a way as to oftentimes dilute the effectiveness of the black vote. That is normative, particularly in a state like Texas. You also need to realize that one of the reasons that this takes place is that the black voter tends to vote against conservatives, vote against the Republicans, vote against the right wing at a higher rate than any other demographic category, oftentimes reaching 9-1. And so it is in the material interest of the conservatives, of the Republicans, to try to dilute, if not obliterate, black voting power. If that were the only problem that we faced, of course, that would be formidable. But to return to the economic question, there is the question of employment discrimination. You've had recently attempts to pass laws, for example, to prevent employers from discriminating against people who have hair like mine. That is to say, it's quite usual, quite typical for black women to face discrimination because of having hair like this, a category that they have nothing to do with. That is the essence, obviously, of blatant discrimination. And the fact that you have to pass a law to address that says more than I could ever articulate.
Well, if you want to talk about the economy, this is definitely an eye-opener. And it's not new news. Joseph Richardson, I don't know if you're even aware of it. Hopefully you are, and perhaps you can spread the word. But there was one report that came out in 2020 by a major U.S. Banking group, Citigroup, that said the U.S. economy has lost $16 trillion because of discrimination. Now, this, again, it came out in 2020. There was another report that came out that was cited by the San Francisco Federal Reserve President Mary Daly that said that the racial and ethnic inequities have cost the U.S. economy some $51 trillion. Now, I do have to say, this is not just lost revenue from blacks, but also people of color. But still, it's a really large figure. You would think the U.S. government would address this, and I think at some point, Joe Biden did address that in his presidential campaign, that he is aware of this.
Well, while President Biden may be aware of it, again, it takes the political will of our policymakers in order to implement and execute policies that will actually effectively address these issues. And so, again, I think what you're saying is has an historical context to it. The work of Lisa Cook, an economist at Michigan State, does some really rigorous scholarship in terms of black patents and the number of patents that have been stolen from black scientists and inventors, and what that has cost the U.S. economy, I think contributes in many respects to the number that you just noted. But we also have to think in terms of and the number of people that are not leaving, that are unable to get a college education, who can create and contribute to the economy by being scientists and incubators of innovation, and how that has impacted black Americans as well, in addition to preventing us from entering into small businesses, by preventing us from getting loans. And we recently saw in Wells Fargo, just in terms of black wealth again, that far more black applicants were denied recently from getting home loans and particularly refinancing loans than white applicants. And so all of this in combination, whether it's the lack of our being able to build our human capital, which ultimately may tie into our social and financial capital, plays an instrumental role in accumulating our wealth. And so the statistics that you just noted, I don't find them surprising at all. No, understanding and knowing the context of the way structural racism has played out in terms of even the scientists and innovation in terms of patents among black people in this country.
Sure. And of course, Gerald Horn, I do have to say that this is not something that the U.S. is just the U.S. experiencing, but also a phenomenon around the world. When this report was described, Gerald Horn, it said, in different, mind you, websites, it said that the report came nearly 2 years after the U.S. experienced what it called a major reckoning on racism in the aftermath of the killing of George Floyd. Now, we know that this type of racism has existed before. Do you agree, or why do you think the reason is that the report or the description of the report is stated as such, that it comes after what it calls a major reckoning after the death of George Floyd or the killing of George Floyd?
Well, I would say that it was a reckoning. I'm not so sure it was a major reckoning, because if it was a major reckoning, we would not be discussing the dismal report that's now on our agenda. For those who may not recall, in May 2020, the black man known as George Floyd was executed on tape by police officers in the state of Minnesota. That led to mass protests across the country and indeed in many parts of the world. That is the so-called major reckoning that took place. But it takes more, I'm afraid to say, than a spate of demonstrations to erode the encrusted bigotry that has accumulated over the decades and over the centuries in the United States of America. And in fact, I dare say that given the fact that inflation is now racking the U.S. economy, and indeed the economies of a goodly number of advanced capitalist countries, you can expect these kinds of dismal reports to be issued regularly, because when there are economic downturns, oftentimes the rate and regularity of racism accelerates. And I'm afraid to say that that's maybe on the agenda as we speak.
Well, it's very alarming, I would think, Joseph Richardson, when you take a look at what the report has said regarding representation in Congress. And it said people of color made up 90% of the population growth in North Carolina, 95% of the population growth in Texas, yet the communities of color in those states have seen decreased representation in Congress. Now, if I'm in the White House and I'm reading this, I should be alarmed, because what if this were to spread to more states? Because as this report indicated, for example, you have a major increase in the number of populations that are the spending that occurs from consumers. And at the same time, you have, for example, incomes that are 37% less than that of white people, as it said, for black people. My question being, there needs to be an equality of some sorts to be applied here, whether it's a representation in Congress, income, and what have you. Do you see any major movements to that effect?
No, but I would say that we have not had the same level of representation in Congress that was reflective of the black population since Reconstruction. We had far more senators and congressmen that were of African-American descent in Congress during Reconstruction than we've had since then. So, I mean, there's a historical context to this, which isn't just playing out recently. I mean, we're talking about well over 100 years. So, and just in terms of, we need to think about in terms of who we are voting for. How are we casting our vote? Dr. Horn mentioned that we typically vote against conservatives, but we also have to revisit, just in terms of our own economic health and survival, what has the Democratic Party done to deliver our vote? And we have several scholars that have made the argument that maybe African Americans should form more of a voting bloc than to just freely give their vote over to the Democratic Party, because it hasn't resulted in any kind of economic advancement for black Americans, whether in terms of economically or even in terms of our civil rights agenda. And so, again, I think we need to retrench and think more critically about what has the Democratic Party done for black Americans in terms of advancing our economics, advancing the health of our communities, our life expectancy, and the educational systems, as well as the criminal justice system, which we haven't seen many gains for African Americans, regardless of what party we choose to elect and place into office. And so maybe it is time for us to think about how we can leverage our vote in terms of leveraging our vote with who needs our vote the most in terms of what we will get out of it and in terms of placing it, specific candidates in office, and not thinking specifically along party lines.
Mm-hmm. Well, Gerald Horn, what do you think about that? At this point, do you see the Democratic Party failing in delivering on its promises, especially when it comes to either people of color or African Americans or blacks? Or do you see that the Democratic Party is not doing that, and therefore there needs to be another kind of representation for, and I'm going to put people of color as a whole, and then blacks or African Americans specifically?
Well, I would like to add another factor, which is that if you look historically, the crucial and critical factor that helps to propel black people in particular forward has been the global context. It's no accident that U.S. apartheid, legalized discrimination and racism, began to retreat 70-odd years ago when the United States is under international pressure as African and Caribbean nations are coming to independence and the socialist camp is bidding for influence amongst those nations. The U.S. decides that the better part of wisdom is to try to execute an agonizing retreat away from the more egregious and horrible aspects of Jim Crow. I agree that left to its own devices, the road ahead for black people will be quite rocky. But that's where our international allies, particularly our allies and friends in Iran, can intervene, because just as our friends in Iran are under pressure from Washington and from the right wing and from those who rule the United States, black people are under pressure from the right wing as well. So I would urge our friends overseas, not least in Iran, to speak out on our behalf, because that would be in your interest and that would be in our interest.
Thank you very much. We're going to end it there. We appreciate that. Gerald Horn, Professor of History and African American Studies from the University of Houston. Thank you so much. Joseph Richardson, thank you. Professor of African American Studies and Anthropology at the University of Maryland. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitahwe and the entire team, it's goodbye. Until next time.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light.
The Creator made Adam in his image, then placed the world in his care. May you walk alongside the Creator in righteousness.
God of Abraham, take my child into thy hands, that he may live to thy service.
God has spoken to us before, through Abraham, Noah, Moses, and through Jesus Christ. Why should we be so surprised that God speaks to us now through Muhammad?
Viewpoint, a critique of movies with religious themes on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to another edition of the program Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio, with me, Mohammad Javad, hosting, and my two guest speakers, Brother Hussein and Sayyid Abdullah. Brother Hussein, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to the program again.
Wa alaikum assalam. Glad to be here.
Welcome. Sayyid Abdullah, how about you? Assalamu alaikum. And it's a pleasure to have you in the studio again.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And the pleasure is all mine.
Thank you very much. Well, we are criticizing the movie Inferno, produced in 2016, directed by Ron Howard, starred by Tom Hanks and Felicity Jones and Ephra Hahn. Let's take a listen to another part of the movie or a trailer, and then we'll be back and ask a question about it.
Spotted Chili.
It's his map of hell. He painted it as an illustration of Dante's Inferno. I studied Dante when I was younger.
Probably in kindergarten.
I was a bit obsessed.
Dante defined our modern conception of hell. Our vision of it hasn't changed since he defined it 700 years ago. Botticelli drew it, but Dante created hell as we know it.
This is what I have been seeing. Torment. Sinners. Branded with letters. Liars covered with rashes. Soothsayers with their heads ripped backwards. Serpent.
The punishment for thievery.
Suffer sinners, pay for your sins. Suffer sinners, pay for your sins.
Back to the program, Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio, with me, Mohammad Jawad, hosting, and my two guest speakers, Brother Hussein and Sayyid Abdullah. Brother Hussein, you know, last time, since we just started, in fact, criticizing the movie Inferno, and Inferno means hell, and it has a stemmed from Dante's Divine Comedy, very famous old book, you know. Well, and I asked Sayyid Abdullah about hell. What is your conception of hell and heaven as a young person? How do you, you know, characterize hell and heaven?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Heaven and hell, of course, are the you know, the concepts or the, you know, the place where we think we go after, you know, after we die. Either we go to heaven or hell, and that is obviously based on, you know, our actions in this world, mm-hmm. at least from an Islamic perspective.
Yes.
So, you know, the more, you know, the more good deeds we have, the higher the chance we go to heaven.
You're right.
The less, well, you know, the higher chances that we go to hell. That's basically it.
Yeah, but what kind of, like, you know, facilities or traits, let's say, would you think and expect to be in the hell?
Well, of course, hell, as described, like, by the Quran, is a place filled with fire. It's very hot, I guarantee you that. Of course, you know, there are different other, you know, descriptions, especially by the Quran and, you know, some narrations on exactly how you would live there and how, you know, the situation would be. But of course, you just stay there for eternity, or sometimes, you know, not you, of course, but, you know, any person who's sinned more mm-hmm. than they've done good deeds in this life.
Sayyid Abdullah, what do you think of hell and heaven?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, hell and heaven, to make it easier to understand, it's when you work, obviously you expect to get paid. And depends on the work that you do mm-hmm. and the money that you get. Same thing with heaven.
I see.
Heaven is just a place where it's got multiple levels.
Mm-hmm.
And each level has different types of, let's say, entertainment mm-hmm. or different types of facilities, like you put it. And depending on how much you work and how much you've earned, you can go to that level and experience whatever being designed for that level. And each level is different in every type, in every way possible.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Same thing with hell. Hell is also a multi-layered kind of facility for people. And each level have certain punishment for certain people for certain sins.
Right.
So it depends on what you do. Are you going to find yourself in one of these layers suffering a certain punishment that's fitting for the action that you've done?
And is that conception true, like hell is full of fire, hellfire, tar, and stuff like that, you know, chastise people?
Look, there are two main conceptions when it comes to hell. There are those who say hell is literal, like there's hellfire.
Mm-hmm.
There are angels that are there just to, I don't know,
torture people,
torture you, put lava through your mouth, put, I don't know, iron rods in your body, boil you to death, bring you back, boil you again, and all this sort of treatment which Allah mentions in the Quran, which mm-hmm. some of them are extreme in their nature.
Yes.
So, and some of them say it's metaphorical, especially from a philosophical perspective.
Right.
A lot of philosophers and mystics,
mm-hmm.
they say, in fact, hell it is within
mm-hmm.
rather than on the outside, just living that regret
yes.
or feeling the extent of the sin itself. Because now when I sin,
mm-hmm.
I don't feel the sin.
Mm-hmm.
But when I get to experience the full extent of the sin itself, the torture that I will suffer from within, it is more than anything that can be inflicted upon me.
Right.
So it depends on which side you take, whether you go with the physical torture or the mental torture. Then we can talk. So if you're the type that goes with the physical type, obviously there's going to be, like the brother said, there will be a lot of a sort of fireplace
mm-hmm.
where there are angels of some sort torturing people based on their sins. And we have like narration or from the Prophet or even the Quran give certain descriptions to certain sins. For example, those who listen to music, lava will be poured through their ears. Those who watch the haram, something's going to come from their eyes. The way they smell, the way they look, everything's been given to us in extreme detail of mm-hmm. what happened in hell.
So is heaven opposite of hell, and is it seven layered like you?
Heaven obviously is a complete opposite to hell.
Yes.
Heaven is just basically a place for pleasure and desire, and whatever you can imagine will happen. Even we have a hadith that says you become a mini god. You mm-hmm. say to the thing, be and it shall.
I see.
Whatever you could imagine, mm-hmm. it will happen. And obviously, to some narration, they do say there are seven levels to heaven. There are narration that says there are levels of heaven as much as the verses of the Quran or the words of the Quran. There are some narration say there are thousands of levels. So it's very hard to pick one specific perspective, say, you know, heaven has that much layers. All we know for sure is that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that heaven itself is beyond your comprehension. Your tiny human brain will not be able to comprehend. You won't be able to even see a fraction of it. So mm-hmm. You just have to wait and see for yourself. And I could assume when it comes to level, because we have you know, the ayah that says that instructs people to do salawat on the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alayhi. They say every time we do a salah, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala increases the Prophet a level.
Mm-hmm.
So could you imagine until the day of judgment how many salawat that would be, which means levels for the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alayhi. So you can talk, we're talking about gazillions mm-hmm. of levels.
Yes, exactly.
So depends, like I said, it depends on how much effort you put, how much work you put.
Inshallah, we are on the right path. And,
inshallah.
Yeah, inshallah. And do whatever the religious guidelines are to the book, in fact, in order to go to heaven. It seems very hard, in fact, to live and survive in hell.
Hell itself, like I said, I think there will be like the mental torture is more severe than the physical torture. Because mm-hmm. we have a, you know, in Du'a Kumail, Imam Ali says, even if you throw me in hell, I will tell the hell dwellers of how much I love you.
Yes.
So that separation, being mm-hmm. away from God and facing your sins, mm-hmm. the shame
that is
you feel
hell in
itself is an absolute hell.
I see, okay.
To face God face head to head and then you can see it.
Yeah.
I think that's what hell is.
I see.
Even they say like, for the mm-hmm. mu'mineen who commit certain sins and they go to hell, they serve some time in jail, and then they come back. They said they get stamped on the forehead.
Yeah.
It says forgiven. Mm-hmm. And even when they go, when they get sent to heaven, that stamp is there. That also gives them a sense of, you know, when people see them in heaven, it's like, oh, this guy was, you know, he got a free pass.
Uh-huh.
And that also gives you that sense of, you know what? Like, you're not going to be comfortable.
Okay. I see.
So, yeah. So there's a, I mean, if we, I want to open the file of heaven and hell, it's a long discussion.
Thank you very much. Let's take a short break by listening to another part. This movie, Inferno, produced in 2016, and then we'll be back criticizing it. Don't go away.
In 40 years, 32 billion people will fight to survive. They'll fail. We're a minute to midnight. Every single global ill that plagues the earth can be traced back to human overpopulation. But serious birth control measures, they don't stand a chance. Outrageous violation of my rights, invasion of my privacy. Don't tell me what to do. And still, we keep attacking our own environment. There have been five major extinctions in the earth's history. And unless we take bold, immediate action, the sixth extinction will be our own. We're a minute to midnight.
Back to the program Viewpoint, the Movie Critique program on IRIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sayyid Abdullah and Brother Hussein, my guest speakers in the studio, trying to help me criticize the movie and discuss the critique of the movie Inferno, produced in 2016, directed by Ron Howard and starred by Felicity Jones, Tom Hanks, and Anne Falcon. Well, Brother Hussein, in this part, we see that or hear that in 40 years from now, the guy says, the antagonist in the movie says, 32 billion people fight to just survive, meaning or reference to the population explosion on the Earth. We are now like having like 8 billion people living on Earth, roughly speaking, you know. The Earth, he says, has seen 5 major natural extinctions, referring to the calamities that happened throughout the world, killing so many people.
Of course.
The 6th one should be our own, he says, because the birth control measures probably don't stand a chance. We have already exhausted our natural environment. We still see our, like, the effects right now, right?
Yeah.
Like the climate change, drastically in different places, especially in Iran that we see, you know, so much drought here pollution, and there. Yeah. Well, doesn't it ring a bell? He's referring, like, the whole movie is about, like, the, you know, scattering a kind of or dispersing a virus, an airborne virus, trying to explode it, like, in underground facility or a basement under Istanbul Mosque that I happen to be. So, you know, I've been there once. Doesn't it ring a bell, like COVID-19? Or is it just a conspiracy theory, if you relate the two? We also see so much talk of WHO and the virus and the stuff like that.
Yeah, of course.
So it really is a familiar scenario, isn't it?
Yeah, of course. There are a lot of, you know, these theories about how, for example, COVID-19 came to be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can believe a lot of different things. But the fact is, it happened, and you can't really change anything about that. Holding the people responsible for, you know, for letting it go or whatever it was, at the end of the day, it's not going to change the present or, you know, what happened so far. So, yeah, this movie does, you know, show a lot of reference to this real-life scenario that we lived. We all lived through it.
And reflect lots of concerns with in the environment.
Of course, yeah. And, you know, it's always been this, like, ethical dilemma in the world and, you know, amongst organizations of, like, releasing these viruses, these biological weapons that can, you know, achieve a goal, but of course, is it an ethical goal? Is the way to do it, you know, is there a right way to do it? If there is a right way to do it, you know, there's a lot of questions surrounding this topic, and, you know, we should be the ones who are, you know, answering it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Brother Hussein and Sayyid Abdullah, for your presence here in the studio with me, trying to criticize the movie Inferno, produced in 2016, directed by Ron Howard, in this program, Viewpoint, the movie critic program on IRIB English Radio. We ask you very much humbly to keep us in your duas and pray for us, especially during Ramadan and more specifically in these nights, the night of ordainment. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
It's Dante's Inferno.
Dante defined our modern conception of hell 700 years ago. Why Dante? Why this map of hell? Someone created a plague.
Without Professor Langdon, no one could find the virus.
Oh my God.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Puriza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters. For the first time since the onset of the COVID pandemic, hundreds of people of faith and none gathered in the shadow of North London's Finsbury Park Mosque to enjoy a breaking of the fast in a public setting. The iftar, backed by the local council and organised by Finsbury Park Mosque, Muslim Welfare House and British Muslim charity Islamic Relief, was an opportunity for the community to gather, celebrate and reflect.
It's good to show solidarity, Muslim, non-Muslim, Jews, Christian, all coming together to share a meal. This is a very powerful message that we are united, we are all at one despite our differences.
It's important because it's a very visible sign of the friendship and, you know, the togetherness that we have all through the year, actually. But and it's such lovely hospitality.
For me, it's an opportunity to, I suppose, show solidarity with my Muslim sisters and also, as Pauline said, to take part in this wonderful experience.
It's no coincidence that this gathering is taking place during Ramadan, one of the most revered periods in the Islamic calendar, a time not just for abstention and reflection, but to help those who are less fortunate.
Ramadan is a time when we're always thinking about our friends, our family, our neighbours, our community at large. And I think it's one of those moments when we can all gather together, especially after the last couple of years when we haven't been able to do that.
The street iftar party was first organised in June 2017, just days after the terror attack in the Finsbury Park area on Muslim worshippers during the month of Ramadan that cost one man his life and injured nine others. The public iftar was a way for communities to show solidarity and silence hatred with hope.
Tonight, we celebrate. We celebrate the achievements of the Muslim community in this area. We celebrate and thank them for all that they do, and we enjoy a wonderful iftar supper.
This is in memory of our beloved brother Makram Ali, who lost his life in this incident, unfortunately. And we are here. We want to have it every year to, and you know, remember what's happened and try to bring communities together after what's happened. And this is the main idea, is to bring us together, to say to those who try to divide us and spread hatred, fear and division that you will not succeed. We are together and we will be always together. Islamophobia has no place in our society, and we should all fight it.
At a time of global disunity, one small corner of North London is showing there is another way. Amina Taylor, London.
The Journalists' Union in Damascus organized a ceremony to pay tribute to journalists who were killed in battlefields while reporting on the years-long war on Syria. Officials attending the ceremony praised the sacrifices of those journalists, who included reporters, cameramen, and employees of media outlets.
Syrian journalists had double the responsibility. They faced a ferocious war waged by huge media outlets on Syria. Journalists wrote their words in blood in respect of their job, homeland, and principles. We remain loyal to the blood of our martyrs.
It was unfortunately a long list of those who were killed, but a reminder of the sacrifices made for the sake of defending Syria. Families and relatives received certificates of appreciation, including one for Press TV correspondent Maya Nasser, who I proudly received it on behalf of his family.
This ceremony means a lot. It means that the martyrs are always remembered in the media outlets they work for. They sacrifice their lives for the sake of the country. We are proud of their sacrifices.
We used to miss him a lot, even when he was alive. He worked most of the time. After leaving for work for a whole month, we saw him once, and then he was killed. It's a nice gesture to honor him by the Journalists' Union.
Maya Nasser was killed by terrorists in 2012 while covering an attack on the Ministry of Defense in the Syrian capital. He was one of many journalists who was keen on being on front lines to deliver the truth and perform his duty. In Syria, tens of journalists fearlessly risked their lives, were injured or killed just to convey the truth amid a ferocious mainstream media campaign to distort the reality. Honoring those journalists underlines the crucial role the media plays in any war, especially nowadays. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
The French presidential election is being described as a populist bloc of Marine Le Pen versus an elitist bloc of Emmanuel Macron, but many don't seem to want to join either group. The first round's third-place finisher held an internal poll. Almost 70% of his leftist supporters will either abstain or submit blank ballots rather than vote for either candidate. France's Muslims don't see a choice which isn't Islamophobic. Macron continues to support bashing Islamo-leftism, while Le Pen has an on-again, off-again plan to give fines for wearing the hijab in public. The student class isn't taking sides either. They recently blocked universities over what they say are two bad candidates.
The elder class may provide the key vote. Back when he expected an easy victory, Macron promised to raise the retirement age to 65. Now he's backtracking in an effort to win over left-wing voters, but many aren't sure what his true plans really are.
Le bilan d'Emmanuel Macron n'est pas forcément positif.
Macron's record isn't very positive. Long-term unemployment, economic instability, the destabilizing effects of the yellow vests. People have many different reasons for being disappointed with him.
In 2017, the two mainstream parties were swept out of power, but the repeat second-round matchup has many voters upset that new ideas remain absent.
La ligne conservatrice, réactionnaire.
The conservative and reactionary line is championed by Le Pen, but she's very divisive. Many of her electorate preferred Eric Zemmour in the first round, and then there are many mainstream conservatives who will never vote for her or the National Rally. The key traits of this vote are bitter abstention and bored indecisiveness.
Most polls show Macron leading by around 6 to 8 points, but that's within the margin of error, and Western polls have consistently undercounted the right nationalist candidate. The runoff is on April 24th. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
There are many security experts who claim the expansion of NATO in recent years close to Russia's borders and provocative military exercises are factors that brought about the conflict in Ukraine. Now EU members Finland and Sweden are poised to announce they want to join NATO. One analyst has been giving us his reaction via broadband.
That's a very serious escalation toward Russia, because this is when the United States will put nuclear bombs in Finland, and that would mean a direct escalation that Russia will not accept.
Finland shares a border with Russia that is more than 1,300 kilometres long. Moscow points out that if this country was to join the 30-nation alliance, NATO's land border with the Russian Federation would more than double in length. A new opinion poll by Le Soir newspaper has found that 90% of citizens surveyed in Belgium said the war worries them, but that they do not support direct military intervention over concerns that it could trigger a new world war. A quarter of those questioned said the West's supply of weapons to fighters in Ukraine is, quote, a bad thing. We have also been asking members of the public about this.
Yeah, I think we should stop doing that, huh? Because war... fights war and then ends up in more war. So it's more about like discussing, talking.
It's a very good thing to have a dialogue with Russians and hopefully sort this out without war.
Ideally, diplomacy is the way that this comes to an end, but it takes two sides. From what I'm reading, they don't want to negotiate at all yet.
On Tuesday, the European Commission defended the decisions taken by EU governments to send arms to Ukraine.
In this case, more weapons doesn't mean more war. More weapons for Ukraine means more ability for the Ukrainian army to defend its people.
As concerns over possible escalation continue to increase, Finland and Sweden are expected to announce, before the end of this month,
if they intend to join NATO. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
People in the west of Afghan capital Kabul were once again terrified after three explosions hit an educational center and a high school, leaving dozens of people dead and injured. Soon after the attack, we rushed Abdulrahim Shahid High School to talk with eyewitnesses.
After the first explosion, I arrived at the scene. Then suddenly the next blast hit the school alley. I saw dozens of students fall on the ground. People started to take the dead and wounded to hospital.
The targeted school is located in Hazara's residential area, where the community has been bearing the brunt of blind terror attacks. People are now calling on the Taliban to tighten the security and protect all Afghans.
I call on the Taliban to tighten security across our country and protect those at risk. My sister and her children are living here. They are horrified. I don't want this situation to continue. Besides, we can't dare to send our children to educational centers. When will poor Hazaras live in peace? They have long been falling victim to terrorism.
The Taliban, on the other hand, claim that they won't let such attacks repeat in the future, vowing to bring the orchestrators to justice.
First of all, we extend our sympathy to the families of the victims. Secondly, our intelligence and security forces are investigating the incident and will hold those who martyred our innocent citizens accountable. I promise our Hazara brothers that we will take urgent steps to protect them against our common enemy. We will also pay major attention to the security of their public places.
Last year, at least 58 people were killed and more than 100 injured in a bomb attack in a girls' school in the same Shia neighborhood in Kabul. In recent years, suicide attacks in western Kabul have taken the lives of hundreds of civilians, including students. People here say they're exhausted by growing violence and terrorism. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
In a Twitter post, the head of Yemen's national negotiating delegation, Mohammed Abdus Salam, said since the entry of the UN brokered truce, the Saudi-led coalition has prevented flights from reaching the Sana'a International Airport and obstructed the entry of fuel ships to the port of Hodeidah.
We have entered the third week of the truce while Sana'a Airport has not been opened yet, as it was supposed. Unfortunately, no commercial flight has arrived, even though the airport is technically ready. We do not know what are the reasons that prevent the opening of the airport until now, but what we do know is that the Saudi-led coalition has not adhered to any agreements since the start of its war on our country in 2015.
Observers say the Saudi violations are threatening the UN brokered agreement, which is supposed to build for a comprehensive political solution. They are calling on the United Nations to intervene and open Sana'a Airport. In the beginning of April, the UN envoy for Yemen, Hans Grundberg, announced a two-month truce. The agreement includes opening Sana'a Airport for two flights per week and allowing Yemen's fuel ships to arrive at Hodeidah Port. For 7 years of war and siege, the United Nations has always been providing the political cover-up for Saudi Arabia's violations of international law. But now that it has brokered an agreement, it should take real measures to force Riyadh to do its part of the truce and open Sana'a Airport. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Dozens of people gathered in the Lebanese capital, Beirut, to mark Palestinian Prisoners' Day, a day when resistance factions and their supporters stand in solidarity with Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails.
On this day, which marks the Day of Palestinian Prisoners, I am certain that the people of the Arab and Muslim worlds, as we see in this gathering, will show the true unity with the resistance and the path of the resistance, especially with the issue of the prisoners and Al-Quds, which are the emblem of the Palestinian struggle.
Hezbollah Deputy Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qasem stressed that one cannot be truly with Palestine if they are not with the resistance.
It has become clear that whoever is with Palestine should be with the resistance. Anyone who has declared that he is with Palestine but hasn't taken one practical step in supporting the resistance is not truly with Palestine. military resistance comes first. The other forms of resistance back and help to serve the actual resistance with arms.
He recalled that after the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, late Imam Khomeini took the decision to close the Israeli embassy and reinstate the Palestinian embassy before declaring he was with Palestine. Liberating Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails has become a struggle for all resistance factions as it is linked directly to the Palestinian cause. They stress that liberating prisoners can only be realized completely by liberating Palestine. Officials of Palestinian resistance groups Hamas and Islamic Jihad considered that history has proven that only armed struggle can be a path to liberating both Al-Quds and the prisoners who continue to suffer from Israel's aggressive policies. More than 4,400 Palestinian prisoners are currently held in Israeli jails. Minors and women are among 500 detainees under the so-called administrative detention policy, under which they are held without charge or trial for an indefinite time period. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Italians have slammed Israel's continued pursuit of repressive, violent practices against Palestinians following the killing of several Muslims, including a teenage boy, by Israeli security forces at the Al-Aqsa Mosque, a major holy site in Al-Quds, last week. Tensions between Israelis and Palestinians have been running high over the past weeks, with Israeli forces carrying out numerous raids in the West Bank, which led to the deaths of a number of Palestinians. The latest round of violence by Israel on Monday saw its soldiers forcing their way into the Al-Aqsa Mosque and removing worshippers from its courtyards in order to allow settlers to exclusively mark the Passover holiday into the compound.
Once again, during Ramadan, a new aggression against Palestinians by the Israeli regime. This time they caught off guard men, women and children who were praying at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. This again has shown the nature of the Israeli regime and the complacence of the international community.
Last year, during Ramadan, similar violence broke out, sparking the biggest conflict in years between Palestinian resistance movements and Israel, an 11-day war which only ended following intervention by international mediators. The violence against Palestinians at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied old city of Al-Quds came at a particularly sensitive time. Ramadan this year coincided with the Christian Holy Week, which ends today, Monday, the second day of Eastertide. Catholic faithful have strongly condemned the latest killing of Palestinians by Israeli security forces.
For the umpteenth time, it is a provocation by Israel. This action were just a fresh provocation. There is a lack of respect for others' beliefs. During Easter time and Ramadan, we have to be more thoughtful.
Tensions, there are due exclusively to Israeli occupation policy. However, the international community seems to have lost interest in the conflict. By not taking any side, the Italian government is supporting Israel in practical terms.
Last meeting between Italian and Palestinian authorities took place in December when Palestinian Foreign Minister Riyad al-Maliki met his Italian counterpart Luigi Di Maio on the sidelines of the 7th edition of the Rome Med Dialogues Conference. Other than reiterating Italy's traditional support for the Palestinian Authority, Di Maio reaffirmed Italy's commitment to a just, sustainable and negotiated two-state solution between Palestine and Israel as the key to stability and prosperity in the enlarged Mediterranean. Max Civili, Rome.
People in the port city of Karachi hit the streets to voice their outrage at the ouster of the elected government. The protesters say the U.S. conspired against their country. While Imran Khan never sought sore ties with any nation during his short-lived premiership,
former Prime Minister Imran Khan has accused Biden administration in Washington for toppling his government in Pakistan, for not towing U.S.'s line on foreign policy.
Khan said that his life is in danger, but he prioritizes Pakistan's independence over his life.
Imran Khan had twice tweeted, or in fact more, but he had a clear message for the U.S. administration that we are partners in peace. We will always be partners in peace. We are partners in trade. We'll always be partners in trade with the whole world, with everybody. But we will not take dictation from anybody.
I'm here specifically to do my part in want